Chapter 14. The End of the Idol. Ukraine seems an unlikely place as a battleground to imperil an American presidency, but that is exactly what happened in 2019, exploding literally just days after I resigned. My timing couldn't have been better. Not only was I a participant in and witness to much of the debacle as it unfolded, but I also seemed poised, for good or ill, to figure in only the fourth serious effort in American history to impeach a president. Throughout my West Wing tenure, Trump wanted to do what he wanted to do, based on what he knew and what he saw as his own best personal interests. And in Ukraine, he seemed finally able to have it all. Ukraine is under intense Russian political and economic pressure. In 2014, Moscow orchestrated the illegitimate annexation of Crimea after intervening militarily, the first change in European borders due to military force since 1945. Russian troops remained deployed across the Donbas region in eastern Ukraine, supporting and, in fact, directing separatist forces there. This major Russian-American dispute proves that failing to act earlier to bring Ukraine into NATO left this large, critically important country vulnerable to Putin's effort to reestablish Russian hegemony within the space of the former Soviet Union. At NATO's April 2008 Bucharest summit, the Bush 43 administration tried to put Georgia and Ukraine on a path to NATO membership, which the Europeans, especially Germany and France, opposed. The tragic consequences were made plain that August, when Russian troops invaded Georgia, effectively placing two provinces under Moscow's control, which remains so to this day. Ukraine's suffering began later, but the pattern was the same. Western sanctions followed, but Russia neither withdrew nor modified its belligerent behavior in any substantial way during the Obama administration, sensing the palpable weakness Obama projected globally. Trump inherited this debacle, but he paid very little attention to it in his first 2 years in office, at least officially. In 2017, Tillerson appointed Kurt Volker, a former Foreign Service officer I knew, as special representative for Ukraine negotiations. My first meeting with Volker in this capacity came on May 10, 2018, when he described his role and priorities. He was then advocating a non-recognition policy on Russia's annexation of Crimea and its military presence in the Donbas along their border. Throughout the remainder of my White House tenure, Volker was a regular visitor, keeping me posted on his efforts. I found him professional and helpful as I engaged with my European counterparts on Ukraine and related issues. My first major encounter with Ukraine itself in the Trump administration came in 2018 when I flew to Kiev to celebrate the August 24th anniversary of Ukraine's 1991 Declaration of Independence from the Soviet Union. Jim Mattis had attended this ceremony in 2017, feeling, as I did, the importance of demonstrating U.S. resolve in support of Ukraine's continued independence and viability. Given Russia's unilateral annexation of Crimea, plus the obvious Russian assistance to and control over opposition forces in eastern Ukraine, this concern was far from hypothetical. I came from Geneva the night before, after meetings on U.S.-Russian issues with Nikolai Patrushev, my Russian counterpart, where I happily told them I was flying from Switzerland to Ukraine for the celebrations. Smiles all around. Whether by Russian intention or not, Ukraine was one of the last issues on the agenda with Patrushev, and we barely had time for it before we both left the U.S. mission for the Geneva airport. In lieu of a real discussion, but to underscore nonetheless how strongly we felt about Ukraine, I said, "I incorporate herewith everything we have said before, and we still mean it." Patrushev didn't say much of anything. On August 24th, I had a working breakfast with Prime Minister Volodymyr Groysman on Ukraine's economy and Russia's increasing efforts to interfere in the upcoming 2019 elections. Groysman argued that Ukraine was a line for Putin, and if he could cross it successfully, he would establish impunity for his actions throughout Europe and globally, which posed entirely legitimate concerns for the United States. Marie Yovanovitch, our ambassador to Ukraine, and several embassy staffers also attended the breakfast and were with me pretty much throughout the entire day. After breakfast, we went to the reviewing stand for the parade on Krashatyk Boulevard, where the 2013-14 Euromaidan demonstrations had taken place, forcing out the pro-Russian Yanukovych regime. I stood on the platform with President Petro Poroshenko and 8 or 10 members of his government next to Prosecutor General Yuri Lutsenko, ironical in light of future developments. Though reminiscent of May Day pageantry in Moscow's Red Square during the Cold War, the parade was politically the opposite. Poroshenko's speech was viscerally anti-Russian, and his loudest applause line came when he vowed to establish an autocephalous, independent from Moscow, Ukrainian Orthodox Church Patriarchate. During the parade, Poroshenko thanked me several times for U.S.-supplied weapons systems and equipment as they passed by, and for the Tennessee National Guard unit that marched with other NATO troops deployed to Ukraine to train its military. Afterward, we rode to the Mariinsky Palace, originally built for Catherine the Great and recently restored by Poroshenko's wife, shortly to be the venue for a large reception Poroshenko was hosting. There, at noon, I met with Poroshenko, Foreign Minister Pavlo Klimkin, National Security Advisor Kostya Yeliseev, and others. We discussed Ukraine's security posture, particularly vis-à-vis Russia and the various threats it posed, not just militarily, but also Moscow's efforts to subvert Ukraine's 2019 elections. Poroshenko wanted to buy more U.S. weapons, and we elaborated our worries about Ukrainian companies selling advanced airplane engine designs to China, concerns that only grew more acute over the year before my next visit to Kiev. After the meeting, Poroshenko took me to another room for a one-on-one where he asked the U.S. to endorse his re-election campaign. He also asked for a number of things that I addressed, allowing me to slide past the endorsement request without being too rude when I said no. What Poroshenko really wanted was for America to sanction Igor Kolomoisky, a Ukrainian oligarch backing Yulia Tymoshenko, who was, at least at this point, Poroshenko's main competition in the 2019 elections. Although it didn't come up in this conversation, Kolomoisky was also backing Volodymyr Zelensky, then leading the polls, but not regarded as serious because, after all, he was just an actor. For liberal listeners, that's a joke. Ronald Reagan, one of America's greatest presidents, was also an actor. I told Poroshenko if he had evidence on Kolomoisky, he should send it to the Justice Department. I filled Yovanovitch in on this conversation as we rode to the next event, a press conference with Ukrainian media. The last meeting was a 2:45 p.m. coffee at Yovanovitch's official residence with various leaders in parliament, including Tymoshenko, whom I had met in the Bush 43 administration and later. The State Department didn't want me to meet with Tymoshenko separately because they thought she was too close to Russia, although typical of the department's methods, that's not how they put it. This joint meeting was the closest I could get to a separate meeting, not that it mattered because Tymoshenko, as the only presidential candidate among the parliamentary leaders, dominated the conversation, not unexpectedly. She reminded me she had read my book, Surrender is Not an Option, always a good way to get an author's attention, and mentioned Senator Kyle's advice to keep moving and keep firing, like a big gray battleship. Well prepared. At this point, only Zelensky was doing well in the polls, with all the other candidates aiming to finish among the top two in the first round, thus getting into the expected runoff. After this meeting, we headed for the airport and then back to Andrews. Not for nearly 3 months did I again have much involvement in matters Ukrainian, until the early afternoon of Sunday, November 25th, when I received word of an incident at sea between Russia and Ukraine. Ukrainian warships and an accompanying tugboat had tried to enter the Sea of Azov through the Kerch Strait, the narrow body of water separating the Crimean Peninsula from Russia proper and over which Russia had recently built a bridge. Our initial information was that a Russian naval vessel had rammed a Ukrainian ship, but later information indicated that Russians had fired what were perhaps intended as warning shots, one or more of which hit the Ukrainian ships. None of this could be accidental. The Russians seized all three Ukrainian ships and their crews, with some of them reportedly injured, although it was not clear in whose waters the ships were when they were taken. Most of this information came through our Kiev embassy, so we were hearing Ukraine's side of the story, at least initially. Because escalation was possible, I decided to call Trump. I wanted to be sure he knew that we were monitoring the situation in case journalists started asking questions. His first response was, "What are the Europeans doing about this?" The answer to which, of course, was, "Nothing, the same as we're doing." The European Union did later put out a statement, but it was the usual mush. Trump's first thought was that Ukraine had been provocative, which was at least possible, given the impending presidential elections. But it was also possible the Russians were looking for a confrontation, perhaps trying in some way to legitimize their annexation of Crimea, which very few other countries recognized. Trump wasn't interested in doing anything quickly, even if Russia was entirely in the wrong. By the evening, Poroshenko appeared ready to declare martial law, which seemed a surprising reaction to an incident at sea. The State Department wanted to issue a strong anti-Russia statement, which I blocked because of what Trump had said a few hours earlier. Moreover, there was every prospect of a UN Security Council meeting Monday, ironically called by Russia, during which there would obviously be a U.S. statement, giving us more time to obtain the facts. Germany's Jan Hecker called me at 7:30 a.m. Monday morning, and the first issue he raised was the Kerch Strait incident. The Germans were cautious, and my impression was that Hecker believed that Poroshenko was not at all unhappy about what happened because of the potential political benefits he foresaw. He would campaign as the strong anti-Russia candidate, Hecker speculated, noting that the Rada was scheduled to vote in about 2.5 hours on a bill proposed by Poroshenko declaring martial law for 60 days. The bill would activate 100,000 reservists for training and also preclude any political activity while in force. Since another Ukrainian law required there be at least 90 days of campaigning immediately prior to a national election, Poroshenko's bill would guarantee the March 31st elections would be pushed back, something surely to his benefit given his low opinion poll numbers. Germany opposed postponing the elections, said Hecker. So far, Ukraine and Russia had given competing accounts of the episode, but the facts remained unclear. Merkel was scheduled to speak with Poroshenko imminently, and indeed, as we were speaking, Hecker was called to Merkel's office to listen in, saying he would phone again when it was over. In the meantime, Pompeo told me he had just spoken with Trump about the briefing he and Mattis were due to give Congress in a few days regarding legislation barring aid to Saudi Arabia related to the Yemen war. During that call, Trump raised the Kerch Strait issue, saying Poroshenko might have provoked something for political purposes. "Let the Europeans own this," said Trump. "I don't want to own it." Pompeo did not raise with Trump State's Sunday request for a White House statement, but he did tell him his staff was trying to water down Nikki Haley's draft Security Council remarks, where she was up in arms against Moscow over the incident. She was taking advantage of the very few camera appearances left as her time in New York dwindled down. Pompeo told Trump he and I would make sure Haley followed his instructions. I suggested we treat Haley's prospective statement as the vehicle to convey the definitive U.S. view rather than having several, and he agreed. Pompeo said he would call Haley and tell her to color within the lines, which sounded right. I then called Trump and told him what Pompeo and I had decided regarding Haley's statement, which he liked, and I also briefed him on Germany's reaction and the Ukrainian martial law legislation. While I was waiting for Hecker to call back, I tried to reach Sedwill in London and Etienne in Paris to see how they assessed the situation. Etienne was not in Paris, but Sedwill called back fairly quickly, and we compared notes on what we knew. Sedwill had already heard that Canada, still chairman of the G7 until the end of 2018, was preparing a draft statement, although neither of us had seen it yet. I told Sedwill what Trump had said over the last 24 hours so the Brits could factor it in. At 11:05, Pompeo called, bouncing off the walls. He said he had called Haley, told her what we had agreed, and that she had also agreed. Then, as he learned subsequently, she immediately called Trump to complain. She read Trump a completely different set of talking points, which Trump accepted. Pompeo wanted a conference call with her and me to get everyone on the same page, but before the call could be arranged, Trump called Pompeo to say Haley's talking points were fine and that he didn't want to be hammered in the press for being too soft. Pompeo and I were perfectly happy to have a stronger statement we could attribute to Trump, but we both knew that Haley was motivated by her desire not to get hammered in the press. Shortly thereafter, in the Oval for the regular intelligence briefing, Trump said to me, "You understand the Haley statement was a little tougher than I said, but that's okay. You probably wanted it tougher anyway, right?" I said I was fine with the statement, adding that we had called on Russia to release the Ukrainian ships and crews, when Trump interjected, "Don't call for the release of the crews. If they don't do it, it looks like the Iran hostage thing. I don't want that." I said I would tell Haley, but by the time I got out of the Oval, she had already made her remarks. Many other countries said the same thing, so I didn't think we would stand out in a way Trump wouldn't like. In any case, the incident provoked Trump to recount yet again one of his favorite stories, involving his first phone call with Merkel when she asked what he was going to do about Ukraine, and he had replied by asking her what she was going to do about Ukraine. When Pompeo and I reviewed all this subsequently, it was plain that we were once again seeing how Haley operated when Tillerson was Secretary of State, as a free electron. That would change in a month with her departure, and Pompeo and I saw it exactly the same, that her successor, whoever it turned out to be, would not operate that way. Light as a feather, as Pompeo described her in a subsequent conversation. Hecker called at 1:30 to finish our conversation, and reported that at a just-concluded meeting involving representatives of Ukraine, Russia, France, and Germany, Russia had said the Ukrainian ships failed to give the required notice for transiting a temporary exclusion zone, permissible under international law for purposes such as military exercises, which seemed ridiculous. In Merkel's conversation with Poroshenko, he said he had modified the martial law bill pending in the Rada, reducing the period affected from 60 to 30 days, thus permitting the March elections to proceed as scheduled. This was progress, although martial law would help Poroshenko politically, and it would bear watching to see if the 30-day period was later extended. It was not. Merkel was speaking to Putin in about an hour to urge de-escalation on both sides, specifically asking that Putin engage directly with Poroshenko. On the morning of November 28th, I flew from Andrews to Rio de Janeiro to see newly elected Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro before the Buenos Aires G20 meeting. I called Trump from the plane at about 8:45 a.m. to ask if he had any further thoughts on the Putin bilateral scheduled at the G20 since Russia was still holding the Ukrainian ships and crews. Trump said he thought it would be terrible to meet with Putin in these circumstances, and that the press would only talk about the Ukraine issue. He said I should get a message to Putin explaining that he looked forward to meeting, but that Russia needed to release the sailors and ships first so the meeting could focus on key issues and not Ukraine. I reached Patrushev in Moscow about 2 hours later to deliver Trump's message, and he said he would convey it immediately to President Putin, who he thought would definitely consider it. Even though he knew I knew the Russian position, he then repeated it to me at some length. I landed in Brazil at about 11 p.m. Rio time. Trump called again to say he would do the bilateral if Putin would announce when it ended that he was releasing the ships and crews, thus, in effect, giving Trump credit for springing them. Considering the time differences, I did not call Moscow. Moreover, changing our position at this point would make Trump look desperate for the meeting, which he probably was. The next morning, I spoke with our Moscow Deputy Chief of Mission, Anthony Godfrey, Huntsman being away, who said the Russians were charging the crews with trespassing. Not a good sign, to say the least. Patrushev reached me as I was in the air to Buenos Aires, saying he had a message he wanted me to convey from Putin to Trump, namely that because of the illegal trespassing of Russia's border, a criminal case, including investigative actions, has been launched. The Russians claimed that, judging by documents they had seized from the ships and the information provided by the crews, it was a military provocation, an operation guided and controlled by the Ukraine's security services. Therefore, said Patrushev, in accordance with Russian legal procedures, the formalities were now underway, so releasing the ships and crews was impossible. He said he was convinced we would do the same, analogizing Moscow's actions to Trump's policies along the Mexican border. There followed a lecture on our actions in recent weeks on that subject, and more. There was little room to mistake Patrushev's message, but I asked how long proceedings against the Ukrainian crews might take. He said he couldn't give me an answer, but would find out and let me know. I said I would speak to Trump and see whether there would still be a bilateral meeting. Trump, it turned out, was running late, as usual, so I didn't reach him on Air Force One until 11:20 a.m. Washington time. I described what Patrushev had relayed from Putin, which I took to be a very hard no. What would you do? Trump asked, and I said I would cancel the meeting. Trump immediately agreed, saying, "We can't give anything away." A tweet to that effect went out shortly thereafter, before I could get back to Patrushev, who declined my call to show how irritated they were. In Buenos Aires, Putin's diplomatic advisor Yuri Ushakov and I met several times to see if there was any way to have a Putin-Trump meeting, which we concluded was not possible given the two sides' respective public positions on the Kerch Strait incident. Instead, Trump spoke to Putin at the G20 leaders' dinner, with no other Americans around other than the First Lady. They used Putin's interpreter, and the U.S. advance man trailing the president couldn't overhear the conversation. The Russians didn't put anything about the meeting in their press, and Trump related to me the next morning he had essentially told Putin he didn't see how the two of them could meet at any length until the Kerch Strait incident was resolved and the ships and crews returned to Ukraine, which didn't seem likely for some time. In a later Trump-Merkel bilateral, Trump implied that a Ukrainian president sympathetic to Russia could help avoid a Third World War. The Russians would have loved that. Ukraine remained basically quiet as we awaited their first round of presidential elections on March 31st, but other matters began coming to the fore. Trump had complained about our ambassador Yovanovitch for some time, noting to me on March 21st during a telephone call covering a number of subjects that she was bad-mouthing us like crazy and that her only concern was LGBTQ matters. "She is saying bad shit about me and about you," he added, saying he wanted her fired today. I said I would call Pompeo, who was in the Middle East. I tried several times to reach him, but didn't because of meeting schedules and time zone differences. After principals' committees later that afternoon, I pulled Deputy Secretary of State John Sullivan aside to convey Trump's direction so he could inform Pompeo. Sullivan knew Trump wanted Yovanovitch fired, so he understood that this repetition of Trump's instruction was serious. A few days later, on March 25th, Trump called me to the Oval, but I found him in his small dining room with Rudy Giuliani and Jay Sekulow, another of his private attorneys, obviously enjoying discussing the reaction to Mueller's report on his Russia investigation. At this meeting, I learned Giuliani was the source of the stories about Yovanovitch, who he said was being protected by a deputy assistant secretary in State's European Bureau, George Kent. I don't think Giuliani knew Kent's job title accurately. Pompeo clarified it for me later. Trump again said Yovanovitch should be fired immediately. I reached Pompeo by phone in the late afternoon to relay this latest news, now with the update that it came from Giuliani. Pompeo said he had spoken with Giuliani before, and there were no facts supporting any of his allegations, although Pompeo didn't doubt that, like 90% of the Foreign Service, Yovanovitch probably voted for Clinton. He said she was trying to reduce corruption in Ukraine and may well have been going after some of Giuliani's clients. Pompeo said he would call Giuliani again and then speak to Trump. The next morning, I called Trump about several matters and asked if he and Pompeo had spoken on Yovanovitch. They had not, but he repeated he was tired of her bad-mouthing us and her saying he would be impeached and the like. Really bad, said Trump. I called Pompeo about 9:45 a.m. to report this conversation. He again protested that Giuliani's allegations simply weren't true and said he would call Trump. I mentioned this to Trump later in the day just so he knew he wasn't being ignored. Whether or not Giuliani's importuning was related to Ukraine's impending election, on Sunday, March 31st, with the returns fully counted, Zelensky finished first, Poroshenko second, putting them in the April 21st runoff. Shortly thereafter, I discussed with France's Etienne and Germany's Hecker how we would all proceed. Although we had earlier agreed to keep hands off entirely, Hecker said Germany was inviting Poroshenko to Berlin, despite risking a backlash from Ukraine if Zelensky won the runoff. Etienne told me that even before the runoff, France had invited both Poroshenko and Zelensky to Paris, which was at least more even-handed. None of us knew much about Zelensky's fitness to be president, and there were concerns about how close he was to the oligarch Kolomoisky, which might raise corruption issues. Worrisome allegations were swirling around, and prudence indicated a hands-off approach. The German and French change of heart, their eagerness to engage, struck me as misguided. There was no disagreement Zelensky was headed into the runoff with a big lead in the polls, based largely on his opposition to Ukraine's substantial corruption problem. Zelensky's support held, and on Easter Sunday, April 21st, he defeated Poroshenko with 73% of the vote. We had a call package ready for Trump if he decided to congratulate Zelensky that day, which he did around 4:30 p.m. our time. I briefed Trump in advance of the call that Zelensky might invite him to his inauguration, the date for which had not yet been officially set, and Trump said he would send Pence instead. The call was brief, less than 5 minutes, but very warm, with Trump opening, "I want to congratulate you on a job well done." Zelensky replied, "Thank you so very much," and said he appreciated the congratulations, adding, "We had you as a great example." Trump said he had many friends who knew Zelensky and liked him, adding, "I have no doubt you will be a fantastic president." Zelensky did invite Trump to his inaugural, and Trump responded he would look at the date and said, "We'll get you a great representative for the United States on the great day." Trump also invited Zelensky to the White House, saying, "We're with you all the way." Zelensky pushed for Trump to visit, saying Ukraine was a great country with nice people, good food, and so on. Trump said that, as former owner of the Miss Universe pageant, he knew that Ukraine was always well represented. Zelensky signed off, saying in English, "I will do big practice in English," so he could speak it when they met. Trump responded, "I'm very impressed. I couldn't do that in your language." A couple of days later, April 23rd, I was called to the Oval to find Trump and Mulvaney on the phone, discussing Yovanovitch again with Giuliani, who was still pressing for her removal. He had spun Trump up with the news that she had spoken to President-elect Zelensky to tell him Trump himself wanted certain investigations by Ukrainian prosecutors stopped. In Giuliani's mind, Yovanovitch was protecting Hillary Clinton, whose campaign was purportedly the subject of Ukrainian criminal investigations, and there was some connection with Joe Biden's son Hunter in there as well. Giuliani was delivering what was all third or fourth degree hearsay. He offered no evidence on the call for his allegations. I said I had spoken with Pompeo on Yovanovitch and would check with him again. Trump couldn't believe Pompeo hadn't fired Yovanovitch yet, and that's what he wanted, no ifs, ands, or buts. Trump said I should find out immediately from Pompeo what was happening, and I should call Zelensky to make it clear Yovanovitch did not speak for the administration. Of course, since we didn't really know what she had said, it was unclear what I should tell Zelensky to ignore. I went back to my office and reached Pompeo about 4 p.m. He said he had already curtailed Yovanovitch from either late November or early December back to June 1st, and sometime before he had so informed Trump, who didn't object. Pompeo wanted to leave it at that. I told him the mood was pretty volcanic because she wasn't gone entirely, which was met with a groan. He again mentioned his previous conversations with Giuliani, who couldn't describe in any detail what had supposedly happened, but who had raised it constantly with Trump over the past several months. But Pompeo said also that in looking at the embassy, the State Department now had a pile of materials they were sending over to justice that implicated Yovanovitch and her predecessor in some unnamed and undescribed activity that might well be criminal. Pompeo closed by saying that he would order her back to Washington that night. With Yovanovitch ordered home, there was no point in calling Zelensky, which I hadn't wanted to do anyway, so I did not. I briefed Eisenberg on this latest Yovanovitch development. A bit later, Mulvaney came to my office with Cipollone and Emmett Flood, a White House counsel's office attorney handling the Mueller investigation. I raised with them something I had asked about before with either Cipollone or Eisenberg, whether Giuliani had ethical problems under the lawyer's code of professional responsibility for using one attorney-client relationship to advance the interests of another client, a dynamic that I thought might be at work in his dealings on behalf of Trump. I said I thought it was an ethical violation to do so, but I was in the minority. The others did agree it was slimy. So much for legal ethics. Earlier that day, I had gone over to Justice to have lunch with Bill Barr, whom I had known since the mid-1980s, before the Bush 41 administration. Barr had become Attorney General, again, in mid-February, and we had been trying since then to find a convenient date to get together and talk about life in the Trump administration. In particular, I wanted to raise my determination to have better coordination when national security interests and prosecutorial equities intersected and might conflict. We needed conscious decisions on U.S. priorities in such events, rather than settling them at random. As someone deeply interested in security issues, Barr was completely amenable to better working relations among the affected departments and agencies. Specifically, however, I also wanted to brief him on Trump's penchant to, in effect, give personal favors to dictators he liked, such as the criminal cases of Halkbank, ZTE, potentially Huawei, and who knew what else. Barr said he was very worried about the appearances Trump was creating, especially his remarks on Halkbank to Erdogan in Buenos Aires at the G20 meeting, what he said to Xi Jinping on ZTE, and other exchanges. I had had essentially this same conversation with Cipollone and Eisenberg for about an hour on January 22nd, shortly after Cipollone replaced McGahn on December 10, 2018. At that time, we discussed Halkbank, ZTE, a Turkish agent Israel had arrested and Trump had gotten released during his July stay at Turnberry in calls with Netanyahu, the question whether to lift U.S. sanctions against Russian oligarch Oleg Deripaska, which was done in early April, Huawei, the implications for China trade negotiations, Trump's personal legal travails, and other issues. I had no doubt of the president's constitutional authority to prioritize among conflicting executive branch responsibilities, such as law enforcement and national security. Nonetheless, in the febrile Washington atmosphere caused by the Russia collusion allegations, it wasn't hard to see politically how all this would be characterized. Whether there was anything even more troubling beneath the surface, none of us knew. Cipollone had not had any previous briefing on these issues, and he was plainly stunned at Trump's approach to law enforcement, or lack thereof. Even earlier, on December 10th, prompted by Trump's Christmas party remarks on Huawei and the Uyghurs, I spoke to Pompeo on these problems and also on questions about the settlements of some of Trump's personal legal issues. The pattern looked like obstruction of justice as a way of life, which we couldn't accept. Moreover, leniency for Chinese firms violating U.S. sanctions, cheating our companies, or endangering our telecom infrastructure could only be described as appeasing our adversaries, totally contrary to our interests. Somewhere nearby was resignation territory, I said, which Pompeo agreed with. This didn't yet require drafting a resignation letter, but warning lights were flashing. Trump called Putin on May 3rd because, as he said with no apparent basis, Putin was dying to talk to him. In fact, Trump was dying to talk, having not had a real conversation with Putin since the Kerch Strait incident forced cancellation of their bilateral at the Buenos Aires G20. Although Trump had announced then that substantive meetings were off until the Ukrainian ships and crews were released, this call to Putin unceremoniously lifted that moratorium, which had lasted since late November, with Russia still holding them. They discussed Ukraine briefly, but to no great effect. Putin wondered whether Igor Kolomoisky would get his Ukrainian assets back, given his financial support for Zelensky's successful campaign. Zelensky, said Putin, was quite well known in Russia because of his television career, and he had lots of contacts there. However, Putin added that he had yet to manifest himself. He said he had not yet spoken with Zelensky because he was not yet the president, and because there was no final result yet. Whether Putin meant the fate of the existing Rada or whether Zelensky would call snap parliamentary elections was unclear. On May 8th, the Ukraine pace began to quicken. At about 1:45 p.m., Trump called me to the Oval where he was meeting with Giuliani, Mulvaney, Cipollone, and perhaps others. The subject was Ukraine and Giuliani's desire to meet with President-elect Zelensky to discuss his country's investigation of either Hillary Clinton's efforts to influence the 2016 campaign or something having to do with Hunter Biden and the 2020 election, or maybe both. In the various commentaries I heard on these subjects, they always seemed intermingled and confused, one reason I did not pay them much heed. Even after they became public, I could barely separate the strands of the multiple conspiracy theories at work. Trump was clear I was to call Zelensky and make sure Giuliani got his meeting in Kiev next week. Giuliani swore he had no clients involved, which I found hard to believe, but I still hoped to avoid getting into this mess. Yovanovitch's firing was already in the press, and a Giuliani visit to Ukraine would certainly find its way there as well. Giuliani also said he was after an official at State, last name of Kent, who Giuliani said was in league with George Soros and very hostile to Trump. I had heard the name before in connection with Yovanovitch, but didn't know him from Adam. I was happy to escape at about 1:55 and return to my office, where I promptly did not call Zelensky, hoping the whole thing might disappear. I had barely settled down at my desk before John Sullivan and Mark Short came charging in, saying Trump had dispatched them from the weekly trade meeting in the Roosevelt Room to talk about Kent. I found these weekly trade meetings so chaotic, I largely left them for Kupperman to attend, which punishment he didn't deserve, but life is hard. Sullivan also barely knew who Kent was, but he described the scene in the Roosevelt Room. Trump talking to him in a loud whisper while Bob Lighthizer went through a series of charts on various trade issues, with Trump obviously not paying attention. After he finished speaking to Sullivan about Kent, Trump turned back to Lighthizer for a few seconds before saying in a loud voice to Sullivan, "Go talk to Bolton about Kent." He then said to Short, "Show him where John's office is." So there they were. Short departed, and I explained to Sullivan the latest Ukraine conversation I had just had in the Oval and asked him to talk to Pompeo as soon as he could. Pompeo was arriving back in Washington by 9 the next morning, and Sullivan said he would brief him then. The issue of Giuliani's trip to Ukraine percolated for a few days without a clear decision. Cipollone and Eisenberg came to see me on May 10th, with Yovanovitch's firing having received more media coverage, although the mainstream press showed little interest, and with Giuliani on his own generating a fair amount of attention. In a New York Times interview published in print that morning, he was quoted as saying, "We're not meddling in an election. We're meddling in an investigation, which we have a right to do. There's nothing illegal about it. Somebody could say it's improper, and this isn't foreign policy. I'm asking them to do an investigation that they're doing already and that other people are telling them to stop. And I'm going to give them reasons why they shouldn't stop it, because that information will be very, very helpful to my client and may turn out to be helpful to my government." The three of us agreed Giuliani couldn't be allowed to go to Ukraine, but the brouhaha also made it uncertain who from the Trump administration could attend Zelensky's inauguration, given the adverse publicity it might receive. Pence's participation therefore looked doubtful, complicated because the inauguration's exact date was still not set. Embassy Kiev was quite surprised on May 16th to hear that Ukraine's Rada had picked May 20th, which didn't leave us much time to check schedules and choose the U.S. delegation. By then, Trump had concluded Pence could not go, and Pompeo decided not to for his own reasons. By the end of the day on May 16th, it looked like Energy Secretary Rick Perry would be the lead, which was justifiable because of the significant energy issues Ukraine posed and the importance of Kiev-Washington cooperation in the face of Moscow's exploitation of energy resources throughout Central and Eastern Europe. U.S. Ambassador to the European Union Gordon Sondland worked hard to be added to the U.S. delegation, but because he had no legitimate reason to attend, I repeatedly deleted his name. Yet in the end, he was on the delegation because, we learned, Mulvaney had insisted. Why the Rada chose such an early inauguration was unclear, but our observers on the ground believed Poroshenko's party decided it was prepared to risk snap parliamentary elections, believing Zelensky could not possibly meet the expectations growing around him. That turned out to be a miscalculation by Poroshenko's advisors and a huge boost to Zelensky. In fact, Zelensky's May 20th inauguration brought the further surprise that he was calling Poroshenko's bluff and scheduling early parliamentary elections. No exact date was set, but the voting was expected to be at some point in July. It also became increasingly plain not only to me but to others as well, including Fiona Hill, the NSC Senior Director for Europe and Russia, that Trump completely accepted Giuliani's line that the Russia collusion narrative invented by domestic U.S. political adversaries had been run through Ukraine. In other words, Trump was buying the idea that Ukraine was actually responsible for carrying out Moscow's efforts to hack U.S. elections. That clearly meant we wouldn't be doing anything nice for Ukraine anytime soon, no matter how much it might help us forestall further Russian advances there. On May 22nd, after addressing the Coast Guard Academy's graduation ceremony in New London, Connecticut, I left Andrews for Japan for final preparations for Trump's state visit, the first under the new Emperor Naruhito. 2 days later from Tokyo, I spoke with Kupperman, who had attended Trump's debriefing earlier that day. It was still May 23rd in Washington when we spoke, from our delegation to Zelensky's inaugural, Perry, Sondland, Volker, and Senator Ron Johnson. It was a classic. "I don't want to have any fucking thing to do with Ukraine," said Trump, per Kupperman. "They fucking attacked me. I can't understand why. Ask Joe DeGeneva. He knows all about it. They tried to fuck me. They're corrupt. I'm not fucking with them." All this, he said, pertained to the Clinton campaign's efforts, aided by Hunter Biden, to harm Trump in 2016 and 2020. Volker tried to intervene to say something pertinent about Ukraine, and Trump replied, "I don't give a shit." Perry said we couldn't allow a failed state, presumably a Ukraine where effective government had broken down, and Trump said, "Talk to Rudy and Joe." "Give me 90 days," Perry tried again, but Trump interrupted, saying, "Ukraine tried to take me down. I'm not fucking interested in helping them." Although he relented to say Zelensky could visit him in the White House, but only if he was told how Trump felt in the matter. "I want the fucking DNC server," said Trump, returning to the fray, adding, "Okay, you can have 90 days, but I have no fucking interest in meeting with him." Afterward, Perry and Kupperman agreed Zelensky should not be invited until after the July Rada elections to see if he had any chance of governing effectively. Several nearby leaders, such as Hungary's Viktor Orban, thought Zelensky's prospects were grim, which was not inconsistent with Putin's standoffish views. There were also rumors Perry was leaving the administration in the near future, so the 90-day figure squared with the notion he wanted the time to achieve something in Ukraine. Senator Johnson told me several weeks later regarding this Trump meeting, "I was pretty shocked by the president's response. I thought it sounded like just another day at the office." Nonetheless, in the following weeks, Sondland, who apparently didn't have enough to do dealing with the European Union at its Brussels headquarters, kept pushing for an early Zelensky visit to Washington. Pompeo didn't care much one way or the other. It was clear he had no appetite for reining Sondland in, despite his normal insistence that ambassadors reported to him, which they did, usually through assistant secretaries, and that he didn't want them going around him to the president. This was par for the course in Pompeo's management of the State Department. Conflict avoidance. Trump resolved the visit issue just before leaving for the United Kingdom in June by saying, "Not until the fall." The right outcome, in my view. Key Europeans also showed caution on Zelensky's prospects. Both German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas and French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian visited Zelensky in Kiev in late May, but formed no definite conclusions. When Trump met with French President Macron on June 6th, Macron seemed to be warming to Zelensky, as was Merkel when Trump met with her at the Osaka G20. However, based on Trump's recent call with Putin, there was no sign Putin was prepared for serious discussions about Crimea or the Donbas, certainly not before the Rada elections.